Hello, thank you for joining me. This is episode 14 of the Sleep to Healthy podcast titled Sleep Coach. I'm Dennis Trumpy, and my goal is to help improve your sleep for your better health and well-being. In high school, I played many sports, the traditional basketball and soccer, but also cricket and rugby. Regardless of the sport, we always had a coach, someone with more experience and knowledge of the game who taught us, encouraged us, held us to account, and helped us improve our skills. Even seasoned professional athletes have coaches. So, why not a coach for sleep? As a listener of this podcast, you might be solidly in the self-help group, someone who prides themselves on learning and improving on your own. But what if you find yourself learning lots, but not improving your sleep to the point you desire? Today, we will be talking with Martin Reed, the insomnia coach. Martin offers a 2-week insomnia training course, free, runs an online sleep forum, and provides one-on-one sleep coaching. So he understands what we can achieve on our own and when we need the help of a supportive coach. Martin has his master's degree in health and wellness education, is a certified health education specialist, holds certification in clinical sleep health, and is an affiliate member of the American Academy of Sleep Medicine. Martin is the founder of The Insomnia Coach at insomniacoach.com. Martin, welcome to the Sleep to Healthy podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
You suffered from insomnia back when you first moved to the United States and married. Can you tell us about that struggle with insomnia?
Yeah, sure. So this was way back in the summer of 2008. I had left the UK, moved to the US to get married. As I'm sure you can imagine, it was kind of a stressful time, a big time of life upheaval. And I found that I started to struggle with sleep. You know, this was something that had never happened to me before. I'd never even thought twice about sleep. But all of a sudden, I was starting to find it hard to fall asleep. I was starting to find it hard to stay asleep during the night. For the first few nights, it wasn't too concerning, but then it just kept happening over and over again. And then I started to really worry about my sleep. Like, had I lost the ability to sleep? Was there something wrong with me? Like, how am I going to do this? I would get into bed. I'd be wide awake. I'd try not to think about sleep. I'd try to sleep. I just seemed to have like no control over sleep. And it was something I'd never thought about before. And it all of a sudden, sleep had become a real problem for me.
And so how did you handle that? What did you do about that?
You know, the first thing that I did, I'm sure many listeners can relate to this, is go online. So I went online to try and get some answers, like what was going on? How could I improve my sleep? And so this was, more than 10 years ago now. And there was a lot less information out there, especially legitimate information. So I had to do a lot of research and try and filter through all the noise that was online and like get to the good stuff. It took me a long time. There were some nuggets that I picked up along the way, and I think that they really helped me. The first thing that I learned was only to go to bed when I was sleepy. What I was tending to do was to go to bed early in the night. When I didn't have a problem with sleep, I'd go to bed at like 11 p.m., maybe midnight, maybe a little bit later. But now I was struggling with sleep. I would go to bed at like 8 o'clock in the evening to try and get more sleep. But I learned that that was really unconstructive because it just led to more time being awake in bed. And this would lead to more worry and make sleep more difficult. So I started to go to bed much later. I'd like try and listen more to my body and wait for it to feel really sleepy before going to bed. And I'd also make a conscious effort to not stay in bed if I was struggling, to start getting out of bed. As soon as I like felt that I was really struggling, like I would be like tossing and turning and starting to get frustrated. Then I would start to get out of bed, read a book, or even just watch some TV until I felt sleepy again. Then I'd go back to bed and repeat that process. So like these were the two techniques that I implemented. They started to, the first way they worked, you know, was I started to recognize that I could sleep again. I still wasn't getting as much sleep as I used to, but because I was going to bed later and I was so much more sleepy when I went to bed, I would spend more time in bed asleep rather than awake. And so I kind of started to regain confidence in my ability to sleep. And this kind of lowered all that sleep-related worry and anxiety. And that's really what got me back on track.
You offer a 2-week insomnia training course, free. In the first session, you ask a question. How are you currently struggling with sleep? What have you learned from the answers to that question?
I've learned a lot, but mainly I've learned that it's typically like the same kind of things that people are struggling with. Primarily, it's anxiety and worry. People with insomnia tend to be anxious and worried about sleep or the effects of poor sleep. A lot of people, too, related to this, they'll feel sleepy. They don't have a problem with staying up until they feel sleepy, but then they get into bed and then they suddenly feel wide awake. You know, there's like this conditioned arousal associated with the bed. It's become learned as a place where we're awake and we're worried rather than asleep and relaxed. Something else that I've learned from answers to that question is that a lot of people have unrealistic expectations or ideas about sleep. You know, this whole myth that we have to get 8 hours of sleep or something terrible is going to happen to us. We're going to have really bad health outcomes if we don't get 8 hours of sleep. Generally, there's like, I would say a 50-50 split between people who struggle primarily with falling asleep at the start of the night, and then the other half of people tend not to have so much trouble with that, but they'll wake during the night and then find it hard to fall back to sleep.
So it sounds like people like understand that they're having trouble with sleep in different aspects. And another question you ask is, what are your biggest challenges when it comes to improving your sleep? So what is it that gets in the way with people improving their sleep?
It tends to be that people just don't know what to do. They've tried lots of things. Like, I've yet to meet someone with chronic insomnia that has not tried to get their sleep back on track in one way or another. Typically, they'll be able to list me about a dozen things that they've tried to do to improve their sleep, but none of them worked. So there's like this feeling of helplessness. That's a real big challenge. This leads to people thinking or worrying that they're losing the ability to sleep. So you have kind of like this combination where people are worried that they just can't sleep anymore and they just don't know where to go from there because they've tried so many things and nothing worked.
So kind of further to that, in the free course, you have three statements, which is you are capable of refreshing and energizing and restorative sleep. You have not lost the ability to fall asleep or fall back to sleep. And you can sleep without sleeping pills. Why did you think it was important to make these particular points up front?
That's a great question. Like, going back to what I said before, so many people with insomnia are just really worried about their sleep and their ability to sleep. So they have, many people have this fear that I can't sleep anymore. So I thought that it was so important to just emphasize the fact that everyone can sleep. You know, like, sleep is a core biological function. It's really similar to breathing. We have some control over our breathing. You know, we can take a deep breath and hold it for a limited amount of time, just like our anxiety and worry can temporarily suspend sleep. But eventually the body will take over and it will force us to breathe just as it will force us to sleep. So although we can get to a point where we're really struggling with sleep, it's so important to remind everyone that you are capable of sleep. And it's our own bodies that make us sleep. Sleeping pills don't make us sleep. They can reduce anxiety and arousal, and that can make it easier for us to sleep. But that sleep is still being generated by our own bodies. So I thought that it was really important to just start the course as the first thing that I would say was just to remind people that they can sleep and that it's possible to get your sleep back on track. We never lose the ability to sleep.
Improving one's sleep often does take commitment and sacrifice, at least in the short term. So what types of issues motivate people to finally overcome those obstacles, to take action, and to commit to a sleep solution that might be uncomfortable or difficult to begin with?
I think this really comes down to when the insomnia reaches a point where it's just really affecting your quality of life. You know, if you get to that point where you're just feeling really lethargic and tired and fatigued, and you feel less productive during the day, you're spending just so much mental energy, you know, thinking about sleep, worrying about sleep. It gets to this point where it can affect your relationships with your friends and your family. It can affect your social life. You know, like you might start to cancel plans with friends because of your insomnia or call in sick to work. You know, this worry and this anxiety can become like a real quality of life issue. And I tend to find that once people have reached that point, they're more prepared to go through any short-term hardship with regards to addressing their insomnia, as long as it leads to long-term improvements and they don't have to go through these really negative quality of life issues.
Now, you mentioned earlier that sleep is a natural process like breathing. I thought your explanation of the arousal system as the enemy of the sleeping systems was very helpful. So can you review the three systems and how the arousal system hijacks the circadian rhythm and the sleep drive systems?
Yeah, so we have these big perpetuating factors of insomnia. Typically, the arousal system takes center stage here. There's like three types of arousal that I like to call it. That we have like this cognitive arousal. This is like the thoughts and worries that can make sleep more difficult. They might not be thoughts and worries about sleep itself. It might just be your general thoughts, worries, or stress about day-to-day life. And that cognitive arousal can make sleep more difficult. We also have like this physiological arousal. This is more of these kind of physical symptoms that we sometimes feel like if we get a racing heart or a sense of panic, you know, like this fight or flight mode. Sometimes when we get into bed, and we can feel like these physiological responses. And oftentimes this is down to another type of arousal, like a conditioned arousal, where we've learned that the bed is like a place of worry and wakefulness. It's no longer a place for sleep and relaxation. And so these three types of arousal can just override our natural sleep drive and our natural body clock, the circadian rhythm, and suspend sleep, you know, because this arousal is seen by the body. It's like a response to danger. Like we're in effect, like thinking of sleep as like this dangerous thing because we've associated it with all these negative emotions and feelings. So our body wants to protect us from this. So it keeps us alert so that we don't sleep. This is primarily what we try and target with treatments like cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia, CBTI.
Well, that leads right into my next question, which is, what is your approach or what systems do you use to help people to solve their sleep issues?
Okay, yeah, that was a perfect lead in. CBTI techniques, which stands for Cognitive Behavioral Therapy for Insomnia. This kind of combines cognitive approaches, which is just a fancy way of saying like your mindset, you know, how you think about sleep. So we try and set realistic sleep expectations, which is based on sleep education, because so many people with insomnia have like unrealistic expectations about sleep or fully sure about how sleep really works. And so just going through a stage of sleep education can actually really help reduce any worry or anxiety about sleep, just having more realistic expectations. And then the behavioral component is all the things we want to implement to further reduce arousal, but also build sleep drive and strengthen the body clock. And when you combine these cognitive and behavioral techniques together, they're just a great long-term solution for insomnia because they're skill-based. So once you've learned them and you're familiar with them, you have them for the rest of your life. So if sleep ever becomes a problem again in the future, you just go back to your mental toolbox and re-implement all these techniques that you've used.
And what aspect of cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia do people have the most trouble executing?
There's two, I would say, and they're the two most important components of CBTI. First of all, you have sleep restriction, which has a really bad terminology problem because it suggests that we're restricting sleep, but we're not doing that. What we're doing is we're restricting the amount of time spent in bed to more closely match the amount of sleep you're currently getting. When I'm working with a new client who's maybe getting 5 hours of sleep, and I say, but they're spending like 8 or 9 hours in bed, and I suggest reducing this down to like 5.5 hours or so, there can be some resistance to that because if we're reducing the amount of time we allot for sleep, then how's that going to improve my sleep? You know, this is the question that people have. But it's so important to explain that what we're doing here is building sleep drive, you know, so you're spending more time during the day awake, so that builds up sleepiness, which helps you sleep. And you're also going to be spending far more of your time in bed asleep instead of awake. And so your sleep becomes a lot more consolidated, and this leads to a better sleep quality, and that helps you feel better during the day compared to if you got a much longer period of lighter, more fragmented sleep. That can be sometimes a bit of an obstacle, but when you explain it and when you justify it to people, most people get that. They understand its rationale. They understand the logic behind it. The second component that tends to be a struggle is stimulus control. The idea behind this technique is we want to relearn to associate the bed with sleep and make the bed a strong trigger for sleep. And the only way we can do this is by making sure the only thing we do in bed is sleep. If you get into bed at night and you're struggling to fall asleep, we say that you should then get out of bed until you feel sleepy again before going back to bed and repeating the process. And this applies too if you wake during the night and you struggle to fall back to sleep. Again, you get out of bed until you feel sleepy, and then you return to bed and repeat the process. So when I introduce this technique to people, there can be some pushback because it's like, well, that just means I'm going to be like a yo-yo in and out of bed all night. And actually, yes, it's important to recognize that that could happen, but this is just a short-term challenge to the technique because with stimulus control, it's like a long-term strategy. Just as it took time for the insomnia to develop and this conditioned arousal to develop, it's going to take time to break it down and rebuild that association between the bed and sleep. Yes, in the short term, the whole process of getting in and out of bed during the night is hard. It's really tough. that as long as people are consistent with it, they do tend to see results within a few weeks, and they'll see that their sleep becomes more consolidated and they have less worry and arousal and anxiety around being in bed.
One of the key goals of this podcast is to change people's lives for the better. We can have great guests with mesmerizing interviews listened to by thousands. But if people's lives are not improving, then this podcast has been for naught. Your sleep success can inspire others to make changes for the better. If there's something you heard on this podcast that resulted in a positive change in your sleep and in your life, drop me a line and let me know. You can record your story on a smartphone and send the file to dennis@sleeptohealthy.com, or go to sleeptohealthy.com for several other ways to connect with me, such as leaving a voice message, texting, or emailing, although I prefer to hear your voice. I will share these stories on future episodes. The story of your success could make a huge difference in other people's lives, probably more than anything I could say or do. On behalf of my grateful listeners, thank you for being courageous and taking the time to tell us about your sleep success. Yeah, and I agree with both those observations. I'm actually often shocked at, with the sleep restriction, that I will end up with a much shorter, as you say, period of time in bed, but it's consolidated in a very deep sleep, and I'll be far more refreshed the next day than I am when I hang around in bed for extra time trying to squeeze out another couple of sleeping episodes before I get up. It's said that insomnia is not a problem. It's a symptom of an underlying problem. From your experience, what are common root causes of people's sleep issues?
Another great question. I tend to find that although poor sleep can definitely be a symptom of a problem like stress or depression, many cases of insomnia don't have any underlying problem that's causing them. Like there's no depression, there's no stress. I tend to find the common root cause of sleep problems is anxiety and worry, usually about sleep or the consequences of poor sleep. And this is really what perpetuates the problem of insomnia, and it can lead to more sleep effort, trying to sleep, trying to control sleep, spending time thinking about sleep. All of these issues just tend to make the problem worse. So that's what I tend to find in my experience working with people with insomnia.
Earlier on, you mentioned the 8 hour a night sleep myth. And on your website, you have a page devoted to success stories. You graph the results your patients experience, and a common graph is the total sleep time. And here are some of the results after sleep training. 7 hours, 8 hours, 6 hours, 6.5 hours. The average is only 6.8 hours of sleep each night, and this is well below the average 8 hours that we see all the time in the media. Like, what's happening here?
That's a great question. First off, the whole idea that we all need 8 hours of sleep is a myth, really inaccurate, and it actually drives and triggers so many cases of insomnia. I know this because people have told me they had no problem with sleep until they tried to get more of it. They were going to bed, not really paying attention to when they went to bed. They were getting out of bed, not really paying attention to that, getting through their day, feeling good. But then as soon as they started to read these things that said, you've got to get 8 hours of sleep, they started to try to get more sleep. And we can't control sleep. As soon as we do this, we make sleep more difficult. And so these people who had no problem with sleep, they read or they heard, or they're constantly getting bombarded with this message about you need to get 7 hours or you need to get 8 hours of sleep. And this is what actually triggered the insomnia and gave them the sleep issues in the first time. And I mean, I talk about this myth a lot in my in the free sleep training course. And I like to use the analogy that, look, we all wear different sized shoes, just like we all need a different amount of sleep. We don't go around asking our friends what size shoe they wear and then worry that our shoe size is different. And sleep shouldn't sleep should be the same. You know, we shouldn't be asking our friends how much sleep they get and then worrying if we're getting a different amount. Just to talk a bit more about like sleep duration, there was a German study and it found that the average 40-year-old adult gets 7 hours of sleep. But this then falls to 6.5 hours for those between 55 and 60. But healthy 80-year-olds were typically getting 6 hours. But even that study itself emphasized that these are just averages because everyone needs a different amount of sleep. In the US, the National Sleep Foundation have actually recognized that for adults between 26 and 64 years of age, as little as 6 hours of sleep might be appropriate. And for adults 65 and over, as little as 5 hours might be appropriate. It's really important to evaluate your sleep, not based on duration, but on quality and how you feel during the day.
So can you dig into that a little bit more of how we judge whether or not we're getting enough sleep? Like what symptoms or signs should we be looking at for during the day to say, yep, I'm getting enough sleep, or nope, I should be doing something to try to get a bit more sleep?
I think it's just generally based on how you feel, which is very subjective. I don't think there are any objective measures for it. So if you wake in the morning, it's important not to judge your sleep based on how you feel exactly when you wake up, because a lot of us experience this sleep inertia, which is like this groggy, fatigued feeling as soon as we first wake in the morning. And this can, it's quite normal to experience that for like as long as half an hour to an hour first thing in the morning. So what I say is, just like reflect upon your day. Like if you're feeling productive, if you're feeling reasonably energetic, then you're probably sleeping fine. The sleep probably is not a problem for you in terms of duration or sleep quality. If you're having a problem whereby you're randomly falling asleep without warning during the day, then yeah, there's probably something at play. There's a problem there. Probably not insomnia, because insomnia tends to be associated more with fatigue than actual uncontrollable sleeps, falling asleep during the day. But other than that, it's really, really subjective. Like if you feel good during the day, then the chances are your sleep is just fine.
So it seems like the people that take these surveys are just asking the wrong question. Instead of asking how many hours sleep did you get last night, they should be asking, how are you feeling today? Do you feel alert? Do you feel like you got enough sleep last night? That would be more useful information than the way they do it now. The other common graph on the page is the time it takes to get to sleep. And the average before starting the training is over 90 minutes. That shocked me. Why do we have such trouble falling asleep in the first place?
This is a really good question. For a lot of people with insomnia, in my experience, it's due to going to bed before they're sufficiently sleepy for sleep. This leads to insufficient sleep drive. You know, sleep drive is one of the core mechanisms that lead to sleep. And this builds up from the moment we wake in the morning, sleep drive is really low. And then the longer that we're awake for, and the more active we are during the day, the more sleep drive builds. And a really strong sleep drive leads to good sleep. So if you go to bed early, you know, like if you're trying to make up for lost sleep or you're trying to get more sleep and you go to bed early, then sleep drive isn't going to be strong enough to help you sleep. So it stands to reason that it's going to take much longer for you to fall asleep. The solution here is to wait until you're sleepy and try to follow an appropriate sleep window. You know, going back to what we were talking before regarding sleep restriction. you are allotting an appropriate amount of time for sleep based on how much sleep you're currently getting. Another issue that I tend to see is, again, this goes back to going to bed before you're ready for sleep. But this time it's more of like a body clock issue. So if you're going, again, if you're going to bed early before your body clock, your circadian rhythm is expecting you to be going to sleep, it could still be sending out these alerting signals, which is what it does during the day to help keep you awake. So when you go to bed early, these alerting signals could still be being released by your body clock telling you to stay awake. But at the same time, you're in bed trying to go to sleep. And the only outcome there is just more time awake. And then the final problem that I see when it comes to like sleep onset is, again, this worry, this anxiety, and this conditioned arousal, whereby you're getting into bed and then you're worried about sleep, or you're trying to sleep. And this makes sleep more difficult and leads to it taking more time to fall asleep.
Yeah, I find for myself, I have to be really careful, probably about 2 hours before going to sleep, that I don't do anything that's going to be especially stressful or trigger the arousal systems. For instance, my wife and I kind of have a rule that we don't talk about any serious issues after about 8 o'clock, because otherwise I'm just not going to get to sleep after that. You have an online insomnia forum on the insomniacoach.com website. So what problem does that help people with sleep issues solve?
Thinking back to when I had insomnia myself back in 2008, I felt really isolated. You know, I didn't see or know of anyone else that had insomnia. So I felt quite alone. I felt like nobody really got it. Like if I said to someone, oh, I'm dealing with insomnia, people are just thinking, oh yeah, I had insomnia, or I have insomnia. Like last night I struggled, but then for the next 3 weeks or 3 months, they'll sleep fine. But they think that like this one bad night means that they have insomnia. So you just feel like no one gets it. And you get this sense of like desperation or worry and anxiety, and you just feel alone. So I set up the forum because I thought that something like this would have helped me when I had insomnia. So I figured it could help others too. And that's primarily why I set it up, is just this destination, this resource that people can go to recognize that they're not alone. You're not the only person awake during the night struggling with this. There's lots of people with very similar problem. So it's there as a reminder that you're not alone. And it's also there as like a peer support group in a way too.
And what have you learned about people's sleep issues and solutions from moderating the forum?
Probably the biggest thing that I've noticed is people with insomnia have far more in common than not. It's so easy to believe that your insomnia is somehow unique, that it's very different to someone else's insomnia. But the truth is like you can see this if you spend time in the forum, is although whatever triggered the initial sleep problem can be, there can be millions of different triggers. When people talk about their insomnia and how it affects them and their experience with it, I mean, you could probably swap almost everyone's story and just change the username and everyone would identify with that story. That's probably the biggest thing I've learned from moderating the forum and being active in the forum, is that insomnia is from person to person is far more alike than it is different. I've also seen that people with insomnia do have a lot of unhelpful beliefs about sleep. You know, this idea that we need to get 8 hours of sleep, or the belief that waking during the night is somehow not normal. I also see that people with insomnia, they have like lots of crutches and rituals that really aren't helpful. You know, like I have to take this supplement, I have to take a bath at such and such a time, then I have to put the aromatherapy diffuser on. I have to make sure I eat certain foods during the day, avoid certain foods during the day. I have to do acupressure. This whole list of rituals, and they're not helping the person because they still have insomnia, but it's even just adding more stress to their lives because they become convinced that if they don't implement these rituals every single night, that their sleep's going to be even worse. I guess also the final thing, just to wrap up the question, is I see that sleep hygiene itself just doesn't work. I don't think I've ever spoken to one person with insomnia who has not tried sleep hygiene, because it's the thing that we're always told to try first. But it doesn't work for chronic insomnia. It can be helpful when combined with CBTI techniques, but as a standalone treatment, it just doesn't work for chronic insomnia. And this can actually end up being quite damaging, because when we're always recommending sleep hygiene to people with insomnia, because when you then try it and it doesn't work, you become even more concerned that there's something really wrong with you, that your sleep system is well and truly broken because sleep hygiene isn't working and this is what your doctor told you to try. These are the things that I learned, just a few of the things that I've learned from the forum.
If you're enjoying and benefiting from the Sleep to Healthy podcast, why not share the good news? When I ask, most people I talk to have one or more sleep issues, and they usually like talking about it. Why not give them the gift of feeling and functioning better, especially when it doesn't cost you a dime? Some people still haven't caught on to podcasts yet. If you really want to do them a favor, offer to take their phone, download a podcast app for them, and subscribe to the Sleep to Healthy podcast to get them started. That's a double favor. Better sleeps and entering the wonderful world of podcasts. Who knows? It might even lead to a date. Yeah, that's very good. And I can believe the fact that there's a lot of similarities there. I mean, even during our discussion today, when you've been talking about the different issues that people have, and I could just keep putting up my hand going, that's me, that's me. So I can see that. And for people, listeners that may want to go in and delve into the forum a bit, what would you recommend in order to receive the most benefit from the forum?
I think the best thing to do is just, you know, be open, honest, and share your story. Sometimes just having a place where you can just open up and just talk and just share your experience, sometimes that can just be really beneficial, even without expecting to receive a response or expecting to get direct one-on-one advice back. At the same time, I do encourage people to bear in mind that this is primarily a peer support group. So I'm in the forum as active as I can be. I'm not there all the time. So it's important to bear in mind that any advice or feedback you get, it might not be relevant to you. There are lots of people struggling there in the forum. At the same time as you could feel supported and feel there's people there that get you, it can sometimes also lead to, like, you're just always reading everyone else's story where they're struggling, you know, because the problem that we have in a forum environment is once people get better, their insomnia is gone, they're not interested in being in an insomnia forum anymore. So you don't really hear the success stories. So sometimes it can feel like a bit more doom and gloom when you're in a forum just full of people with insomnia. So that's just something that's important to bear in mind.
That's a good point. Your main focus is cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia, or CBTI. Are there other methods that you have used with success or that you combine with CBTI?
Not now. Now my professional work is 100% CBTI techniques because I've seen how effective they are. I've experienced how effective they are. One thing that I would say is really early on when I was first struggling with insomnia, I experimented with brainwave entrainment, which is like a type of audio file. And you listen to it and it plays sound waves that attempt to mimic the frequencies associated with sleep. And the idea is that when your brain hears these sound waves, it like copies them and it helps it sleep. When I tried this, I thought what I was doing it at the same time as I was implementing CBTI techniques. But I thought that it was maybe these brainwave entrainment audio files that were helping me. So for a while, for a short time, I actually did recommend and I even sold brainwave entrainment audio sessions. But after a while, I actually realized and recognized that it wasn't these brainwave entrainment files that were helping me sleep. It was the CBTI techniques. I soon stopped selling brainwave entrainment audio files, stopped recommending them, even talking about them, and just really focused in on CBTI.
You want people to take their sleep seriously, yet you don't want people to have anxiety because of their sleep problems, as it can make their sleep worse. How do we resolve this conflict of interests?
Great question. You know, everyone with insomnia takes their sleep seriously. You know, I think they're probably the only people who actually do take their sleep seriously. People that don't really struggle with sleep don't really think about sleep. And this tends to actually be what the problem is. As soon as we take sleep really seriously and we try to control sleep, we make sleep more difficult. What I try and say is, although we can't control sleep, we can help set the stage for sleep. And I like to use this surfing analogy where like a surfer always wants to catch that perfect wave, but there's never any guarantee. But there are definitely things that a surfer can do to increase the likelihood of catching that wave, just as there are things we can do to increase the likelihood that we're going to get a good night of sleep. You know, so the surfer will check the forecast. It will only go out like when the conditions are right. And someone with insomnia can improve the conditions by doing things like only going to bed when they're sleepy, following a regular and appropriate sleep window, getting out of bed at the same time every day, getting out of bed when they can't sleep. You know, all these techniques that really give you the best chance for success, they're the things that we have control over. So that's what I try and get people to focus on.
Now, you mentioned earlier about sleep hygiene and, you know, by itself, it's not going to solve somebody's insomnia. But I often think of it as something that it won't solve your insomnia, but if you don't pay attention to it, I think it can perpetuate insomnia and kind of undermine other efforts that you're making to improve your sleep. And you have a sleep hygiene test on your website where we can fill in answers and then the page returns suggestions for improving our sleep hygiene. Where do people most commonly have problems with sleep hygiene?
I think the biggest sleep hygiene problem that people have is to do with like an irregular sleep schedule. But I really think that this is more of like a CBTI technique, you know, like the sleep restriction following a sleep window, more than a sleep hygiene issue. More often when it comes to sleep hygiene, the emphasis is on things like not exercising too close to bedtime, not doing anything too stimulating before bed, making sure that your bed is comfortable, there's not too much light or noise, you know, these environmental issues. But the problem with this is there are so many people that have no problem with sleep, do an intense workout just before bed. They'll play video games just before bed. They might not have curtains in their room. They sleep just fine. If sleep hygiene was really a problem for people with insomnia, then it would be a problem for far more people. And as soon as you implemented these sleep hygiene techniques, insomnia would be solved. But it's not, because by itself, these sleep hygiene techniques just aren't effective. You know, when academics are doing research on effective insomnia treatments, when they're forming their control group, they tend to give sleep hygiene to the control group. And the control group is also known as the no treatment group, because we know that sleep hygiene doesn't work. So we give that to people as knowing that it doesn't work, because that would serve as a great control group. So I think it's quite important to just always bear in mind that, like you said, sleep hygiene can be helpful, but it's unlikely that poor sleep hygiene is causing insomnia. So focusing our attention 100% on sleep hygiene isn't really constructive.
That's really interesting about using the sleep hygiene as the control group, because you know it's not effective, and then so much information out there focuses on sleep hygiene. You offer a paid insomnia coaching program, and when people pay for a service, they expect results. What kind of results have you experienced from your clients?
Sometimes the transformation that I see in clients is just inspiring. I have clients that have all different types of insomnia in terms of if it's sleep onset or sleep maintenance, and with different histories of insomnia. Some people might have had insomnia for a few months, others a few years, others for decades. And when I see this transformation in their sleep, it's just so inspiring. And it's really important to emphasize that I'm not putting the work in. You know, it's the clients that are putting the work in. I'm just their guide. So I always try and make the client success story, just emphasize that all client success is down to the clients. I'm just there to support them and help them on their journey. Every client that I work with who implements these CBTI techniques, they see improvements in their sleep. And I know that you talked, you pulled out some statistics from the success stories page that I have on my website. One of the measures that I have is sleep quality. And it's purely subjective. I just ask clients, as soon as they enroll on the course, how would you rate your sleep quality? And the average sleep score that people give me is 3.8 out of 10. That's what they rate their sleep quality as when they first enroll. By the time they complete the course, right now, the average self-reported sleep quality score has gone to 6.8 out of 10. But then, because these CBTI techniques are skills that last, like they stay with you for the rest of your life, you stick with them, your sleep continues to improve, even though you've graduated from the course and you're not working with me anymore. And I try and keep in touch with clients after they stop working with me. And sticking with their sleep quality, what I found is that 1 month after they stop working with me, their sleep quality score has gone up again. It's like 7.4 out of 10 is the average now. 3 months after the course ends, we're seeing average sleep quality scores of 7.8 out of 10. And then 6 months after the course, we're seeing sleep quality scores of 8 out of 10 is the average right now. So I could talk about success stories all day, but I think sleep quality is really important. And that's really the ultimate barometer, because if you feel like you're getting good sleep and you're feeling good during the day, really, that's all that matters.
Well, that's great that you record the before and after, and especially the longer term as well, because that's ultimately what matters the most. And if it's still going up, that's a very positive sign. As we near the end, I have a fun but serious challenge for you. I'm going to put up thousands of billboards on highways and in cities on your behalf throughout the English-speaking world. What message do you want on those billboards and why?
This is a really hard one, because I would like a really big billboard. But if you're just giving me a standard size and I had to choose one thing, it would have to just be, you do not need 8 hours of sleep, because that is such a driver of sleep problems. Because as soon as we're told how much sleep we should be getting, as soon as we try to get a certain amount of sleep, sleep becomes a struggle. So if I could only put one thing on the billboard, I think that would have to be it.
You know, I think we might be able to start a GoFundMe program and get that thing going. As we wrap up, what is one thing that our listeners could do today to improve their sleep tonight so they can feel and function better tomorrow?
I would say have no expectations about how well or how poorly you might sleep tonight, and only go to bed when you feel sleepy enough for sleep. Oh, I think that might have been two, but it was one sentence, so I'm going to stick with it.
Thank you. And where should people go to learn more about you and the resources you have available?
Well, there's primarily my website, insomniacoach.com. On there, I have the free two-week sleep help sleep training course that introduces people to these CBTI techniques. And a lot of people have actually managed to get their sleep back on track just from the two-week sleep training course. But you can also learn more about my individual one-on-one sleep coaching programs. I have an online coaching course and a phone coaching course. And that's for those who are like really ready to jump right into implementing these CBTI techniques and get the personal guidance and support as they go through the process. I'm also on Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, and Instagram as well.
And as always, we will have the links to Martin Reed's website, your two-week free insomnia training course, the Facebook page, Twitter, YouTube channel, and Instagram, all at the show notes at sleepthehealthy.com. Martin, through your education, your experience, the online forum, the feedback from your two-week insomnia course, and your one-on-one sleep coaching, you have developed a powerful and thorough perspective into our sleep issues and solutions. Thank you for sharing those with us today.
It's my absolute pleasure, and it's a privilege and a pleasure to be on. Thank you for having me.
Let's summarize some of the key points Martin Reed made today. The first that came through loud and clear is to stop worrying about how much sleep you're getting. If you feel rested, then you're doing fine. If you don't, then get some help. But keep your eyes off the clock. The second is to focus on the things that actually help improve your sleep, sleep restriction, and stimulus control. You know, it's a bit like work. You can be busy, or you can be effective. The two are often not the same. Don't spend too much energy being busy with sleep hygiene. Do the heavy lifting of sleep restriction and stimulus control for the most impact. The third is that when you learn good sleep skills, the skills can last you a lifetime and even allow your sleep to improve with time. So, although learning sleep skills may be an effort and discomfort, the payback is enormous. As always, you can find the detailed show notes about the interview with Martin Reed, along with all the links at sleepthehealthy.com. This concludes our episode for today. Other episodes related to today's topic include episode 9 with Dr. Stephanie Silberman, on cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia. Thank you for keeping me company today. I look forward to you joining me next time on the Sleep the Healthy podcast. This podcast is not a substitute for advice from a qualified healthcare professional. The sole purpose of this podcast is to educate and entertain. As we do not know your particulars, we cannot and do not provide professional or medical advice or services. We strongly encourage you to consult a healthcare professional before incorporating any ideas from this podcast. Listeners who use the information in this podcast do so at their own risk. The guests on this podcast express their own opinions, beliefs, and conclusions, which is neither supported nor opposed by the podcast and host. The podcast does not fact check information provided.